Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 20th of July, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Alex Thompson. Alex, thank you very much for joining us from the depths of the Netherlands. And you've been able to see some of the best British countryside here in Devon, because, of course, we've got the mountains of Dartmoor. And, well, we've got a very interesting news today. I'd just like to say a welcome to our BBC spectators. We've mentioned in the past that apparently members of the BBC news team and management like to tune in to UK Column Live. So welcome today. And we will have a small segment talking about the BBC and, of course, those extremely large salaries. But we're going to kick off today with the subject of children. And Tim Farron has been speaking out again. Over to you, Mike.
Yeah, he's at it again. So he was up to his old tricks regarding unaccompanied refugee children. Yesterday, he asked what was described as an urgent Commons question on the issue. So let's have a look at what he had to say.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I thank the Minister for his response. It does seem in the light of the fact, though, that those are somewhat hollow words. Before the election, the government promised they would transfer 480 refugee children from Europe to the UK. In the other place recently, the government admitted that so far only 200 unaccompanied children have been given sanctuary here. When does this government expect to fulfil this measly commitment? And will the Minister today give us a date? I say it is a measly commitment because the UK government could do so much more. Freedom of Information Act requests show that local councils have voluntarily offered to accept 1,572 more children in addition to those they already support. Does the Minister know this? And in light of this information, will the government reopen Dubs and take its fair share? So summer approaches. More are taking the dangerous sea crossings across the Mediterranean to reach the safety of European shores. More desperate refugee children, without anyone looking after them, will arrive in Europe. Yet the government has said it will not take, will not consider taking, any child under Dubs who arrived after their arbitrary cut-off date of the 20th of March 2016. Now, in the light of the delays, which are the government's fault, will they now extend this date, which is as heartless as it is pointless? Now, finally, I have visited the camps in Greece and elsewhere, something that neither the Home Secretary nor the Prime Minister, who is, of course, the previous Home Secretary, have done. I cannot forget what I have seen. I have met those children who, through no fault of their own, find their lives on pause as ministers here choose to ignore them. How many children, then, have been taken from Greece to date under the Dubs Amendment? Has the UK government even signed a memorandum of understanding with Greece to get these transfers underway? Now, I know of two young people who signed a consent form to be transferred under Dubs over a year ago. They are still stuck in Greece. And the horrific truth, Mr. Speaker, in closing, is that the longer this goes on, the more likely that these children will go missing and fall into the evil hands of traffickers.
The hypocrisy is unbelievable. So he says he's been to Greece, but he hasn't been to see any of the care homes where these children end up in Britain, and hasn't done anything to do with children going missing from care homes in Britain. So Brandon Lewis then responded by saying the government is fully committed to helping and supporting the most vulnerable children. We have contributed significantly, he said, to hosting, supporting and protecting vulnerable children affected by the migration crisis. This is part of our wider response of taking 23,000 people from the region. We've already granted asylum or other form of leave to over 8,000 children. Local authorities across the country are currently supporting 4,000 unaccompanied asylum seeking children. So, as I say, at no point did Tim Farron or Brandon Lewis mention the children brought to the country who have gone missing since they entered the British care system. So if we move on to the next one, Brian, let's just remember that in last year in November, the NGO ECPAT UK and the charity Missing People released this report, heading back to harm. 167 of 590 children suspected or identified as child trafficking victims in the UK in the year from September 2014 to 2015 vanished from foster and care homes across the UK. 593 of the 4,744 unaccompanied children placed under the protection of local authorities also went missing at least once in the same time period, and of the 760 trafficked or unaccompanied children who disappeared from care, 207 have never been found. So that's 207 children that were brought to this country for safety, as Tim Farron wishes, have never been found, having disappeared at the other end of the care system. The report also said that the majority of child trafficking victims who vanished from care are from various countries, including Vietnam, Albania, and others. But it's not just unaccompanied children being brought into this country that are at risk, because let's remember again that the 2012 All-Party Parliamentary Group for Runaway and Missing Children highlighted the fact that, as they said, and this is a quote from them, there is a scandal going on in England involving children missing from care, and until recent cases of child sexual exploitation in Rochdale and other places put the spotlight on this issue, it was going on pretty much unnoticed. Tim Farron, it's not unnoticed as far as he is concerned, because he's been told about this, but he will not engage on the issue. So let's move on, Brian. Tim Farron continues to promote, as with the question yesterday, bringing more children into this country in the full knowledge that it doesn't necessarily make them safer. And he continues to deny that he has any responsibility to guarantee their safety while they are the responsibility of the state. And I've got to ask why, Brian.
Well, that's the key question, Mike, isn't it? Why these people will not act and take the appropriate action. Hypocrisy from Tim Farron, because, of course, you and other people took the trouble to email him with the details about the missing children. BBC carried one of the reports, which was that over 350 Syrian children were now missing in this country, brought here for sanctuary and were now missing. Nothing further was done. And of course, then Tim Farron said quite calmly, well, yes, I'm sure some of them have been trafficked or used for sexual abuse or even worse. But he was not prepared to do anything. And policing minister Brandon Lewis, of course, almost wins the total prize, because he had a full report from that very brave Metropolitan Police officer, John Wedger, who told the story about how children were being taken out of care homes, children's homes, and they were being trafficked, groomed, prostituted, and some of them ending up dead in the gutter. What did Brandon Lewis do as policing minister? Nothing whatsoever. Alex, this is the real state of the British government at the moment. In my book, if you have a government that is prepared as a minimum to cover up the abuse of children, then you can't trust that government on any other subject.
Ryan, a key point, I think, is that if such abuse is being covered up in the government itself, such as knowledge of children going missing who have been brought in under the government's own aegis, then we can be sure that ministers are equally prepared to cover up their knowledge of others below, at the same rank or even above them, doing the same to children. And you're quite right, the abuse of children is the absolute apex or nadir of evil. Everyone in the world is agreed on that across all religions and philosophies. And unacceptable for it to happen a single time. But of course, if it's going on with any scale, then all the other lesser abuses, crimes against adults and against property and against national heritage and against sovereignty, are obviously going on, because that's child abuse is obviously the last crime to be committed with impunity. And where it is going on, there's a huge long tail of other abuses going on behind it.
I've got to say exactly, and I'm going to add that I've already used the word sanctuary. What we've been hearing over a number of months now is that particularly immigrant children coming into Britain and going by preference to sanctuary cities. If you're not familiar with this term, certain cities around the country have labelled themselves sanctuary cities for immigrants. They say, we look after people, we care for people, we protect people coming in from overseas, particularly if they're asylum seekers. And yet within the sanctuary cities, it is the authorities themselves, children's services, the local authority, and indeed members of the police, who are actually covering up the abuse of those of children of those immigrant communities. And mothers who come forward to say their children are being abused. What one of the tactics being used is that the local authorities or children's services will leak the names of those mothers back into their communities, where they are then coming under horrific pressure, sometimes beaten. Some of them have, we believe, been raped as a result of going to the authorities. And one particular city of interest at the moment is Sheffield, where there is overwhelming evidence of this type of activity, including judges in court refusing to see video evidence directly relating to the abuse of children. So we've got this at government level, Alex. We can then follow it through. We can see a pattern within local authorities. The police or some members of the police are on board. What's the driving force? Well, perhaps we can come on to this slide here, which is from The Telegraph. Why the explosion in child snatching? And the explanation given by Christopher Booker is because it's big business. And I think this is a very, very powerful article, because Christopher Booker has gone right to the heart of the matter, that everything to do with children is money. The moment a local authority can pinpoint a child to be taken, that child is worth something around £75,000, £78,000. The amount of money grows accordingly. But he starts his article saying here, a Norfolk reader sends me photographs of an advertisement placed on the back of local school buses by Norfolk and Suffolk County Councils. New challenge, it reads, have you thought of fostering? If so, you can earn £590 a week. And he quickly makes the point to multiply that by a number of children. You're into big money. Alex.
I'll tell you something about that, Brian. I was on holiday in Dubrovnik in Croatia a couple of years ago, and this isn't meant as a snobbish remark, but just to give people an idea of who was sitting behind me, I would say the usual Essex girl stereotype. So young, artificially blonde ladies, a certain type. And they were talking, obviously, behind me in the bus on the way to the Old City. And I was thinking, I'll have a listen in to see what British tourists are talking about when they're relaxed and don't know who is around them and don't think other nationalities or assume other nationalities are there. And their conversation very quickly turned to a respectable middle-aged, middle-class British lady who had taken on a child as a foster child. And for 15 minutes, they regaled each other with ways in which this woman took the money and treated the foster child as a second-class child, didn't take it to any activities, extracurricular activities, scolded it a lot more, abused it verbally in some cases. And I don't say Essex girls as a means of being snobbish, just to say that people with lesser information to access to information and less knowledge of the world than others have thoroughly understood that fostering with this kind of plastering, and I've also seen this happening in Luton and other parts of Britain, the adverts from the councils, that's obviously going to attract people whose main interest in fostering is pecuniary, and you end up with children being farmed.
Let's bring in the second part of that slide, if I can, Mike. I've added it at the bottom there. So Christopher Booker went on to say, most people have no idea what a big business fostering has become when one such firm, the National Fostering Agency, representing 175 local authorities after being launched by two ex-social workers in 1995, when it was placed on the market by the Rothschilds in 2012, it was sold by its venture capital owners, Sovereign, to a private equity firm, Graphite Capital, for a staggering £130 million. And I'll add to that, there's another company which I find of great interest called Core Assets, turnover of £198 million, all around children. There's something deeply uncomfortable about this. And of course, the British government is fully involved in this. There's no question the British government knows the abuse is going on, and it knows that many of the children are being procured through the so-called child protection system. This was also an interesting article from The Telegraph. It's about a little baby boy who's been very sick, terminally ill, in fact. And the NHS refuses to treat the little boy anymore. He spent some time, I believe, at Great Ormond Street Hospital. Parents knew that there was a possibility of treatment in America, so they were fighting through the courts for their son to be treated. But the courts ruled that he shouldn't have any treatment, and that was obviously going to lead to that little boy dying. Now, what's emerged is that CAFCAS, who's been acting in court for the child, this is the way the British state works, it brings in CAFCAS supposedly to act independently for the child. They appointed a barrister, Mrs. Butler Cole. She's supposed to be acting in the best interests of the little boy, but the parents were very dismayed to find that she was actually chairman of an organisation called Compassion in Dying, and that's the sister body of Dignity in Dying. Now, the parents say the implication of this is obvious, that how can a barrister who is all for dying be actually looking after the welfare of their child? This is now broken into the mainstream press. So the Telegraph, in a couple of days, has covered some very powerful articles about children. I'm just going to add this in before we move on. This was a memorandum of understanding between CAFCAS and the Family Law Division going back to 2010. And of course, what this shows is that absolutely no separation of powers between these two organisations, because CAFCAS is working with the Family Law Division. So as far as common law goes, this is a complete outrage. And of course, we can now see how the courts themselves can be manipulated to help take children. And I'm also going to hit home at CAFCAS with this report. You can freeze it on screen and read it. But this is a gentleman who resigned from his job in CAFCAS back in 2011. And in the text, you can read that he's saying that this organisation is, in fact, unfit for purpose. But nevertheless, these are the sorts of organisations that are brought into the court in order to displace the parent from their child. And then once the child is taken, well, if they're sick, they are going to die, as in the case of that little baby boy, or they're going to disappear into a care system where they can be procured for abuse. So I'll just pop this on screen. This is a little bit of the report from this organisation, Compassion in Dying. And what I wanted to highlight here is that in this section here highlighted, they're boasting of the number of government departments that they're working with. So they're working with the Parliamentary Group on Dementia, Public Health England, the Care Quality Commission, and the National Institute of Health and Care Excellence. So we have a funny little organisation set up on the back of grants from a number of wealthy families. That then becomes the organisation which advises the government on what policy should be. This is democracy pushed to one side. Alex, this is participatory democracy.
Yes.
Using charities and NGOs.
Newer viewers might not know what we mean by participatory democracy. It sounds a very sweetness and light phrase, doesn't it, Ryan? But it's a replacement of representative democracy. And it is dividing people into identity-based groups on their race, age, gender, etc. And then setting up champions for them. Who, in the purest sense of the word, are commissars. This is a Marxist idea. You have a commissar for children, a commissar for animal rights, a commissar for the rights of nature. And if you look around the more Marxist-leaning countries in the world, in Latin America and some in Europe now, they are actually going even beyond the rights of children, supposedly being championed by these bodies and charities, to a level where people can be sued by a champion of nature, for example, for polluting the environment, because supposedly the dolphins and the trees can't speak, but we have a quango that can speak on its behalf. So it's an extremely cynical way of splitting up existing society. And as usual with Marxism, you have to wreck before you can build. trouble is they never get to the building stage. They only continue to wreck.
OK, well, one organisation which certainly isn't reporting on problems around childcare and missing Syrian children is, of course, the BBC. And we'll just come back for a couple of days to this report where grossly inflated salaries of BBC presenters started to come out. Of course, not all of them. There's a scam going on. But we had Chris Evans here on £2.2 to £2.25 million. For his efforts. BBC lists him as an entertainer. Well, I don't find him entertaining. And £2.2 million for this man, amazing. Lineker, I believe, what does he do? He kicks a, no, he used to kick a ball around.
And then he ate a packet of crisps. That's how he's usually remembered by the youth now, remember?
Yes, yeah, so he was reasonably good at playing football. He doesn't play football anymore. He can eat crisps. But according to the BBC, he's worth £1.8 million. And in fact, from what I've read, it could be more than this because he also operates a private company which interacts with the BBC. They don't have to reveal the figures. And the final guy there, whose name escapes me, and I'm very happy with that, he's on just under £1 million.
Oh, that's Graham Hancock, isn't it? Trust me to be the one out of the country for several years and who never watched this cruddy TV anyway, but... I recognise that as Graham Hancock.
OK, well, there we go. That's the sort of money. And, of course, where does that money come from? It comes out of the licence.
Graham Hancock is a much finer individual who's written about ancient civilisations.
OK, we got him pinned down in the end, and I'm not at all embarrassed for not really being able to recognise him. So where can we go on this? Well, this is another part of the Telegraph reporting on this, and they brought in a list... of the top people. So we've got Chris Evans at the top. We can see Gary Lineker there. Oh, there's Graham Norton as well. Jeremy Vine on a cool £750,000. These are utterly outrageous salaries, particularly when we look at the poverty, the trouble with caring for people in care homes or nursing homes or the NHS and the BBC paying out these salaries. Now, some of the cover-up was achieved via this because the BBC said, oh, we can't reveal the salaries because we don't pay the individuals directly. Some of them actually work through BBC Global or BBC Worldwide, and that's under a separate contractual relationship, so the public is not to know. So that's part of the network of companies. We pay licence fee. What has the BBC done with that public money? It's created these massive profit-making news companies, and now they can hide salaries behind that. So the picture is not good, and I couldn't resist bringing this one in because the BBC has done its own reality check of BBC reality. A little bit of an oxymoron coming in here. And what do they do? Well, they take what we would consider to be massive corporate greed, obscene salaries, which are created on the back of public funds, collected by Capita with a reputation for bully boy tactics. But the BBC says, well, no, it's not to do with the size of the salaries. What it's to do with is a gender pay gap issue. Alex, this is very skillful manipulation of the news. This is propaganda. This is more than spin. This is playing with people's minds.
Well, yes, it is, Brian. And not least one of the aspects that needs to be covered here is if you speak of a gap, then obviously you're talking about two items between which A and B, there's a distance. But two genders is very old hat, isn't it, Brian? There's supposed to be 58 or 85 genders, but not when it comes to gender pay gap stuff.
Well, please go on reality check and read this one and you'll see what we're getting at. It's not a problem that you pay somebody £2.5 million. The real problem is that the ladies in the BBC don't get paid £2.5 million as well. Mm. And where we wanted to get to was the serious stuff, because, of course, while the public is being distracted with the BBC's gender gap, we've got the BBC's own charity, Media Action. We've shown this many times before, and we're delighted to show it again, because here we had the charity boasting via this lady, Juliet Harkin, that they were operating in Syria in 2004, working with members of the community who were trying to unseat the government. And I find this just utterly incredible. This is not reported in the mainstream press at all. We've got a furore over big salaries. But what's the real danger of the BBC? Subversion. How do they get away with this, Alex?
Well, if you go around the places where the BBC hang out, Salford Quays in Manchester now, it's a lot of them because one of the slides you just showed showed 2,000 people there, but 10,000 more in London. If you go anywhere near there, you will see that there's the big shots swarming around, but there's also these legions of people like this Ms. Harkin here who are just in the background and not really talking to the main people in the BBC, and they seem to cluster in their own cafeteria areas inside and outside the building, wear distinctive dress which says, "I am not of the plebs." And they just form a community, really. And if they emerge from their warren and the BBC premises at all, it does seem to be to go to talk to the FCO or the Department for International Development or the like, rather than to the public. So yeah. they're in a hive mind of their own, really, and the BBC has enough of an underbelly to hide them from view.
Right. What would we be reporting now if an element of government-controlled TV in Syria was boasting that it had been working to help unseat the Westminster government in UK?
This would, of course, be front page news that Assad was subverting and undermining us, and that we would need to set up a special wing of the intelligence agencies to deal with it.
Yeah. So we pay those big salaries to take the public's mind off what's happening behind the scenes. Run through these very quickly just to make sure for any new viewers to UK Column that we've done our homework. Please check this yourself. But if you go into BBC Media Action's annual reports, we chose this one. This is from a couple of years ago. But you can see what they say they're doing. Our work in the Middle East and North Africa was a particular note this year as the events of the Arab Spring. Well, did they report the Arab Spring or were they helping to create it? Is that too extreme, Alex?
No, I don't think so. I was in several of the countries of the Arab wave just before they were Arab sprung. And the thing that struck me overwhelmingly was that, okay, there were some complaints about people being locked up. But that was because there was a lot of bad boys. Assad has said it himself, hasn't he, that we have a lot of policing in Syria. Maybe that's because there's a lot of things to police.
Indeed.
And these societies were keeping the lid on things. Gaddafi most famously said, if you're stupid enough to get rid of me, then you'll have a deluge. So all of the North African countries and some of the Levant ones as well were keeping a lid on things for us and for their own safety.
OK, and we'll come back to it. We've added a bit here. Overview. The year marked a significant change in the identity and scale of BBC's international development charity. It talks about funding. You just mentioned that, Alex. And in there, you'll see that it's talking about £90 million, which has come from the international which has come from the Department for International Development. So we think this is a charity, or we're supposed to believe it's a charity. It's nothing of the sort. This is an operational arm of the BBC. It's being funded by the British government to help overthrow foreign countries.
And always bear in mind
the 90 million.
I always bear in mind, Brian, that DFID is now running the FCO, is my analysis, that they've been at this for 10 or 15 years. The real British policy, the soft power stuff, is done through DFID to keep it at arm's length from the FCO.
But really, it's the Foreign Commonwealth Office. So this is direct central government policy working overseas to destabilise countries.
I know more than that. I think the FCO is being told to obey DFID, and DFID has got much more NGO participation in it than the FCO would be allowed to have. So
okay.
It's a way of sneaking in more NGO stuff.
Well, we'll follow through these quickly. We just got some examples of BBC Media Action intervention. So here they are boasting about what they've been doing in the Middle East. They're talking about the former Soviet Union states. They're talking about working with the US Department of State. Here they are in Afghanistan. Anywhere there's a trouble spot in the world, we seem to have BBC Media Action. And they claim they're independent of the BBC, except, of course, when they're feeding off the pension pot. So this is out of their own accounts. Some UK employees are members of the BBC's pension schemes, the BBC Group. Now, of course, the BBC Group does not have itself any status at law. This is a generic term. When you try and get into the group to see who's who and how they work together, it becomes amazingly complex. Well, we'll leave the BBC there. But, Alex, the BBC never too keen on reporting matters to do perhaps with Israel or George Soros. And you've picked up on this video from the internet. What's happening here?
This is from the Israeli Prime Minister's YouTube channel, and quite surprisingly, Benjamin Netanyahu, known as Bibi often, who is their second from the left, appeared in Hungary for a state visit and also to speak to the Hungarian-headquartered Visegrad Group, which is the four countries of Central Europe, Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia and Hungary, who form a closer alliance than the EU. It's kind of a Central European Benelux and are just as serious or more so than Benelux. Here he is at the Visegrad's conference, and among all these figures, quite well known to Europe watchers now because they've turned against the Franco-German policy of mass migration. You've got Beata Szydło there on the right of Poland, Robert Fico of Slovakia, Viktor Orban hosting in the middle, the Hungarian Prime Minister, and the Czech Prime Minister there on the left. In the middle of this, he says some rather uncomfortable truths. He says that Israel is actually a safer place for Christians and other minorities than any of its neighbouring countries. And, you know, people might be surprised to hear him talking like this, but I think he means it genuinely. I mean, I don't think that Netanyahu is the fount of all the evil that comes out of Israel or the Zionist scheme. And in this case, I think he's saving his skin and genuinely protecting his people from being overwhelmed in the way that Central Europe is also trying to stop happening to it. So he's basically saying, here we are forming a front down the east, central and eastern part of Europe to protect the Europeans from themselves. And as you see on the right here, he's tweeted out, thank you for the warm welcome. It was a family-to-family state visit. This is a major turning of the tables. Soros was never hugely popular in Israel, but there has been this lazy assumption in the alternative media for a while that the whole of the Israelis are behind Soros and others like him in their funding and of destabilization of countries. Not at all. Hungary is actually finding an ally now.
Right. I don't think we've got a report on it today, but we've been hearing that there was a hot mic when Netanyahu was actually talking about the disarray inside the European Union. So there's very interesting things start to be happening. You sense fragmentation amongst the sort of world powers. Nobody quite knows where anybody is at the moment, whether it's inside the European Union or we're talking NATO and the EU military unification. It's all uncertain.
Yes, and the analysis that people in our circuits have been putting out for years that states and alliances like the EU are not driving policy, that it's actually currency blocks that do so and that the bankers behind them, that's being vindicated. If you look at our Insight Vox interview on the UK Columns YouTube channel, if you go to the playlists and then Insight Vox, you'll find it. Skousen says that there's been a long tradition of the West using technology transfer through Israel to the Asian powers, Russia and China, to build up opposing forces, because in a situation of tension, you can more easily control things. And Israel seems to be pulling away from that now. And in that hot mic, when he was speaking in closed session to the Visegrad Group, he actually said, we have a special relationship with China. He's admitting, you know, all of this. But he's saying that the problem is that the Europeans are shooting themselves in the foot with the mass migration, the failure to check the migrants, the open luring of them to Europe. And he says that he can't understand that the European Union is putting conditions on its relationship with Israel. People who watch our UK column may be very cynical about all this because of the history of what Israel as a state has done to its own neighbours. But I think there is a genuine move here, that the demographics and the thinking in Israel is shifting, and shifting in a more positive direction. And Netanyahu is actually riding on the coattails of that. So it's very much a kaleidoscopic moment, really. The power blocks are up in the air. And
right.
We can see that on the next slide, in fact. We've got Haaretz, the premier paper of the secular contingent in Israel, talking about this Soros law. So what's happened is that an Israeli member of the Knesset, MK, called Mr. Zohar, has tabled a bill to prevent anyone being involved in Israel who is funding anti-Jewish activities. And in fact, we covered last week how when the anti-Soros posters had been put up courtesy of the Hungarian government in Budapest, you remember that I said that there was immediately the cry of anti-Semitism. But Netanyahu put immediate pressure on his own foreign ministry to put out a press release described here on the right-hand column in our Haaretz article the very next day, saying, we wish to clarify that while we are against anti-Semitism, we have no problem with legitimate criticism of Soros, which is undermining Israel's democratically elected governments by funding organisations that defame the Jewish state and seek to deny it the right to defend itself. This isn't just a feint, as far as I'm concerned. Soros and his NGO mentality is now a threat to Israel, which is becoming actually a more sceptical nation as time goes on.
Alex, are we starting to see here really the upper level hidden hand?
Yes.
And by that I mean that a lot of people will point a finger to say it's America causing this problem, or it's Israel causing that problem, or Britain causing it. In fact, what we're looking at is people behind the scenes at extremely high level. They can manipulate politics and politicians. They can manipulate these NGOs. They can create charities and NGOs for political purposes. That requires money, so we know they're linked by money. Soros demonstrates that. But are we now starting to see these people having to reveal themselves? Because if we've got a nation state like Israel starting to ask questions, they know the spotlight's coming on them. Who
yes.
are they?
Ah, well, they're a few financiers, mainly from the City of London, and they control, through the pyramid which has the Bank for International Settlements at the top, they control the world's money supply, and also, as David Ellis and Evertizer are pointing out, by forming currency unions, they can also affect the fate of nations through military procurement, which is why we're now seeing EU military unification. And no state is entirely going along with this agenda. Even people who question whether Israel had a role in 9/11, maybe some level of its government did, should not be misled by that into thinking that Netanyahu and his cabal of Jewish and American neocons are the top of the pyramid. These men are now genuinely concerned for the future of the Jewish state and the Israeli people. So, as you say, Brian, the hidden hand behind is becoming rather more evident.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's switch to Mr. Macron, and he's apparently worried about the Eurozone at the moment.
Yes, Macron is, by virtue of being French president, is currently the chairman of the Eurozone, the group of countries which have the euro as their currency. And we've actually, I think we may have missed out a slide there on which Emmanuel Macron was warning the German journalists that they were profiting illegitimately by the strength of the euro. But in any case, that's why the title here is It's Not Just Macron, because that would have been the previous slide. But this one, we see a very respected economist, Joseph Stiglitz, by many accounts the fourth most influential economist in the world, saying that 2017 could be the end of the game, the collapse of the euro. Unfortunately, he's not prepared to accept that the euro was built up in the first place for bankers and for the creation of military unification. He still sees it as a noble attempt to bring the peoples of Europe into greater prosperity, but he's warning that the game is up, you see.
So we've got yet more flux at
yes.
the moment, uncertainty and flux,
yes,
worries over the euro money. Mm-hmm. But while that's going on, what are we seeing? We are seeing the continuing build-up for unified EU military.
Yes.
So we have to say today that well done to David Ellis, who's been reporting over so many months and warning what was coming with this EU military unification process. We know that David Ellis has had some very interesting contacts over the last couple of weeks from people who previously didn't want to speak to him. He was not in the club. Certain organisations and individuals thought he was a little bit beneath them. Now, all of a sudden, he's getting emails and telephone calls saying, can you tell us a bit more about what you know? Now, this headline is taking us into the heart of it, isn't it? Franco-German alliance rising, the Macron plot, biggest armament plan imaginable in Europe. This on the back of financial trouble and collapse. This has got to be immensely dangerous.
Oh, yes. And the left-hand article there was about the French and Germans forming their own defence pact, which is the really the keystone of what David Ellis has been warning was going to happen, that the French would have a group of nations which were bilaterally linked into pacts with them, notably Britain, thanks to Mr. Cameron in the first place, which we've been covering since 2010, and the Germans would pull in the Central European nations. That's happened, we've been covering it. And now the keystone, France and Germany have said, we're not going to have any British or American involvement in our defence in future, we're going to do it ourselves, and this particularly relates to fighter aircraft. As a result of this announcement, which involves the greater part of €1 billion of cuts to the French defence budget, the Chief of the Defence Staff has resigned on principle. So obviously he wasn't with the agenda. And the right-hand article, which is from Les Echos, describes how the new chief of the general staff in France, François Lecointre, is of a younger generation and made his name in the Balkans. In other words, he's one of the aggressive pro-NATO types who were already willing to fight Germany's wars back in the 90s when Germany wasn't allowed to do any such thing. Now the gloves are off, and as the left-hand article is pointing out, and sorry about the pornography on the page, that's just the Express for you. The French have actually made a deal that when the Dassault Rafael goes out of service and when the Germans' lease of America, sorry, of Tornadoes goes out of date, instead of doing a new lease or French design, they're going to have a German design, which they're going to cover under the fig leaf of Franco-German. And that, again, is the gloves off and back, takes us back to the post-war period and the falling apart of all those gentlemen's agreements, because one of them was that Germany would never produce fighter aircraft, because we all know as soon as they put their minds to it, even from zero, they produce something as good as Russian stuff and better than American within a year or two of trying. So that's now going to happen again. You know, the old purpose of NATO to keep the Americans in Europe, so the Germans down and the Russians out, it's all been nixed now.
The old powers are rising. Yes. And I know this is part of a tweet, and just for you comment on it, I'm going to say the moment I saw your comment here, I'm thinking this is interesting, because on one hand we've got the French boasting of their pact with the Germans, but actually the French are always clinging on the coattails of the Germans, because this shows that they are not sure, are they?
No, Macron, I'm very much in two minds about, and this was the slide I was referring to, sorry my error that they were out of sequence, but here is Macron. There was a lot of controversy over whether he was going to give any press interviews for Bastille Day, the 14th of July, the French national celebration. And he was being a bit of a poseur and saying, oh, you will see on the day. Well, in the end, he called some German journalists to his palace at the Élysée. And as I've underlined in red at the bottom of the screen there, he says, OK, there's been some winners. He's talking in his capacity as chairman of the Eurozone here, the Eurogroup. He's saying there's been winners, particularly you Germans, out of the Eurozone. But you have to realise that Germany is profiting from the dysfunctionality of the Eurozone. And this is not a healthy and not a sustainable situation. So he's warning that, he's obviously a Rothschild man, but in his capacity as representing French prestige, he's saying, we understand that we're having the life sucked out of us here. And as usual, the French approach to this is to cling to the German underbelly and say, if you keep, let us keep our prestige, we will work like stink for your system so that you don't roll over us, basically. So we're going to see the resuscitation, as with Charlemagne, of the French and the Germans. So the old powers, as it were, the ones above the state level, are quite determined that out of the ruins of the EU, there is going to be a Franco-German beast again.
Powerhouse. Yes. Yeah. And, of course, we've got warnings for that also coming from Irish MPs. I was fascinated by this one.
Yes, this is a Tuath the Dáil, a member of the Dáil, Richard Boyd Barrett. If you go to Facebook, and the group name is People Before Profit, as the name suggests, it's far left. But as often, we have to be honest about this, the far left discover things more quickly than others and often trumpet them more boldly than others while the rest are still asleep. And here, Mr. Barrett is warning, and the video contains two men speaking very sensibly in central Dublin there about it. He says that the whole principle of the Irish Free State in 1922 and again when they became a republic in 49 was that they would stay out of NATO, and they weren't even supposed to join the EEC in 73. There was a lot of hoo-ha about that because they were supposed to be a strictly neutral state like Finland and Austria and Switzerland. And this is being brought into great calamity now by Irish involvement at the budgetary level in the EU military unification. And Barrett and his cohort here are saying there's always been a plan for a European military beast. So it's not just the Brits talking about this now and not just Tory types either. These are far-left Irishmen.
OK, well, we're just going to follow this through because Britain loses its military, loses control of its military. We cease to exist as a country. There's no ifs and buts about this. So let's bring in this headline from the Express. Navy's new 3.5 billion aircraft carrier HMS Queen Elizabeth needs protecting by French warships. And this is the harsh reality. We've got this incredibly expensive pair of aircraft carriers, well over $6.5 billion for the two. I've just put up this tab at the top left-hand corner. I was intrigued to see that the Express, I think, there's a little bit of Mickey taking that we've got $6.5 billion of two carriers that are going to be used for, quote, soft power. I think the government is beginning to lose sight of what's what, but you're having massive new aircraft carriers because you're projecting soft power, apparently. We'll add this bit here because the BBC in reporting was very interesting. There are some reports that say that Queen Elizabeth class carriers are going to take 36 F-35s, immense problems with those aircraft, but says that they're going to carry 36 of them each. But in the BBC report, the BBC said, well, we think it's going to be about 12, in which case they're going to be carrying fewer aircraft than the original Ark Royal Invincible Illustrious.
I think I've got it, Brian, because the Charles de Gaulle is going to be decommissioned when? I know it's limping out of port these days, but...
Shortly. I don't know the exact timescale.
So this QE2 is, of course, an Anglo-French asset, Franco-British. Okay. The Dassault Rafales are probably incompatible, you would know the details, with our aircraft carriers. And it would be a bitter pill to swallow for the Royal Navy to have to be handling Rafales on deck. So what I think is we're going to have the token 12 F-35Bs on deck, and the rest of it is going to be made up with the Neuer Messerschmitt, basically, which is probably going to be planned right now. I expect they've been planned for years, and this is just the announcement. So an advanced German fighter jet, I think, is going to be trumpeted at some point in the next year.
Right, that's a very interesting statement. Now, I've got an eye on the clock, but we'll just run through these last ones because it paints the whole picture. Bring in Michael Fallon, Defence Secretary. This is not a direct quote from him. It's a quote from Royal Navy sources, but ultimately he's responsible. Last night, Royal Navy sources confirmed that the supercarrier will avail itself of French anti-submarine frigates, which will escort it during both NATO and non-NATO operations. And other nations will also chip in on a needs basis. So Britain's defence is under Theresa May, as she's better known, and Michael Fallon, who, of course, his expertise is in children's nurseries. We're going to conduct the defence of this country by a few people chipping in when they've got the assets available.
It's well below the level of language we expect from a senior Secretary of State, and obviously to give him his proper old-fashioned name, he's the Secretary of State for War. He's supposed to have his acts together, isn't he? And now he is talking about chipping in on a requirement basis. You know, it's the level of the language of petty bureaucracy, which is infected.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And we'll just add this one. Our armed forces face ever-evolving threats, so we must invest in cutting-edge technology to ensure they can operate in hostile theatre and project soft power. I mean, we're in nonsense land here. This is like watching a cartoon instead of serious matters of defence. I'm going to put on screen here, of course, it was the UK column that warned about these plans being brought together in 2008. We were talking about it 2010. Franco-British Council, another one of these mysterious charities that was right at the heart of forming Britain's military policy in closed-door meetings. The UK column broke the story warning about what was going to happen with the carriers. Royal Navy builds for an air threat but misses the enemy within. And, of course, the enemy within was the European Union. And we absolutely warned that basically the intent was to get the carriers jointly manned with the French, but the Brexit vote destroyed that. So I'm going to say that the UK column has consistently been accurate in its reporting over these disastrous defence measures. But we're now in the stage where we've got an expert in children's nurseries apparently running the defence of the country. We need to stop this, I think, Alex, do you think?
Yes.
The public needs to start taking the right action.
Yes, and particularly anyone who's been involved with the military or the intelligence services who's realising that EU military union is more than a conspiracy theory. Was it Clegg who called it a dangerous conspiracy theory? It's time for you, whether you're in service or retired, to get off your backside now because you're pledged to uphold the nation. You know, you've got either an oath, which you swore if you're a military officer, or you've signed the Official Secrets Act. And even if you've done neither of those things, you owe a duty of loyalty. And misprision of treason is still an offence in common law, isn't it? Which
Indeed.
Is knowing that treason's going on and doing nothing about it.
Excellent. Thank you for that, Alex. I couldn't wish for a better note to end on. So if you're a senior retired officer and you're out there on the golf course today, or hopefully watching UK Column later tonight, perhaps you might reflect on those comments. We better end there. Alex, thank you very much for joining us. It has been immensely hot in the studio today. It's very oppressive in Plymouth, and bright lights indeed. I'm going to say, if you're not a subscriber to the UK Column, then please consider making a subscription. We can only do what we do with your financial help, but we would like to expand what we do, and that requires ongoing finance. So if you're not a subscriber, how about subscribing and or making us a donation? That's it for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Bye-bye.